online. Ok.
Yeah.
Beatrice Barro.
Do everyone yes.
Okay. So I'm thinking about this kind of education that kind of sparked in the US in the 60s and 70s, which was a progressive formal education, which left, you know, which was based on the idea of a child that was really free in the educational context. So a child with rights, a child who would drive the educational process by, you know, being left free by the teacher to do based on further interest. So I'm kind of thinking about, and actually this kind of form of progressive education is quite prominent still in the US, I take it, so especially in the private educational context. So I was just wondering whether you have any thoughts about the relation between a context like that and your idea of better education, right? Because we've talked about a very interventionist context like the one in Russia, but this is a kind of completely opposite scenario, right? Where, yeah, freedom is kind of interpreted in the problem.
What's an grazie. It's an excellent question. But one of the things that's interesting about that moment of progressive educational practice in the US is that it was reserved for the children of the upper middle class, and it was actually in the service of realizing their potential, so that it, although it seemed to be a form of freedom, it was actually in the service of bourgeois empowerment. And it was the idea that these are the people who are meant to be the master class of the world in any case. So they should learn to use and assert their creativity. But their creativity was not designed to allow them to decide to become impoverished poets. Their creativity was designed to allow them to express themselves and ultimately to be harnessed toward the ends of the marketplace. And these are the people who grew up to be the captains of the banks during the 70s and the 80s, and whose creativity included creative bookkeeping, included all the things that led to economic crises around the world. So it's the problem was not the progressive education per se, it's that in fact the education wasn't really that progressive. All of the so-called freedom was overseen by instructors whose goal was to empower these particular class of this particular class of children to believe in themselves as creative, and then to, as they moved from being children to being pre-adolescents and then to being adolescents, to progressively allow them to think that they were still being free when they were in fact being constrained. And it was a very Foucauldian form of freedom, in that it was essentially carceral freedom.
Struck by the way that you mobilized the concept of privacy in Harry Jekyll's. And of course, we know that probably in particular in the US history, how this concept of privacy was so crucial and fundamental in, for instance, access to contraception rights or abortion rights, etc. I remember you mentioning something about how Harriet Jacobs produced obscenity by putting into the public discourse that obscenity that she was denouncing, and that she, in a way, could do so by being authorized by a normative subject that was the one who brought the introduction. And that reminded me of many similar histories in the production of self-narratives. So in transgender self-narratives, for instance, those are authorized by somebody in the medical profession who writes the introduction. And also in disability memoirs, oftentimes the introduction is written by either an educator or notably sometimes a parent too. So that there is a literary mechanism that allows that obscenity to go into the public discourse. So this said, I was wondering if you could briefly come back to the point of, again, of education, because going back to also what Lorenzo was saying about discourse in Italy, but also in France, I think the situation is comparable, the discourse of ultra-Catholic and far-right. And what struck me about this is always that they are, they use this victimizing rhetoric based on claim on freedom of expression. So in a way, it seems to me that they're like, that their discourses are actually borrowing frames and strategies from identity politics and minority rights, okay? So that the point is not simply to anymore, I think, to protect that liberal right to privacy that allows sexuality to stay in the shadow and prevent the child from knowing that non-normative sexuality exists or that sexuality exists in general. And so basically to keep the child uneducated, the point is then to explicitly educate the child to unnormative sexuality. So in, yeah, I think, I don't know if this is because of the more general state of the sexualization of culture, but it's basically getting rid of the enjoyment, really.
Is that the question part?
Yeah.
You see, I don't think they're getting rid of the enjoyment part, unfortunately. Or fortunately. I mean, let's go back to the premise of your question, that it is no longer a concern, they're no longer concerned with preventing the children from having access to information about non-normative sexualities. They're actively promulgating a normalizing sexuality. I don't think there's an absolute difference between those two things. The imperative has always been to promulgate a normative sexuality, but to do so now increasingly by forbidding access to any information whatsoever about alternatives to normalcy within the framework of state-run institutions or within the framework of civic society in general. So that in France, for example, a great deal of the opposition to the question of marriage for all has shifted now to this concern about what's happening in the school system. And interestingly, going back to the conversation we were having before about migrant communities, it's largely being the figures at the forefront of this movement, which is largely being organized by the Front National, are nonetheless themselves often immigrants, members of the Islamic community in France, who are being used as the face of the Front National in order to give us an appearance of representing the voice of the people in a sort of democratizing movement that unifies the immigrant and the nationalistic citizen against the queer threat that is seen as permeating the school system, because permeating the state insofar as the state is now run by socialist government. So the state itself has been corrupted, and it's not for nothing that the opposition to the law in France of marriage for all law was opposition largely to the minister who presented that law, Christiane Taubira, who is herself a woman of color from a French colony, and became the lightning rod for this opposition that demonized her in the most savagely racist forms. So the joining of these two sets were these two sets of of resistances to transfer the transformation of French society were not about getting rid of enjoyment. They were fully the expression of an enjoyment, the enjoyment that comes from precisely racism and homophobia. I mean, to fail to recognize the enjoyment implicit in homophobia is to fail to recognize the universality of queerness. The gay bashings that took place in response to that particular moment in French history, and there was a dramatic and quantifiable upsurge in them, were the expressions of enjoyment. And that, of course, is what those of us who are interested in queer theory must take to heart. Because if we are the spokespersons for enjoyment, if we are seen as the figures who are defending the right to enjoyment, we have to be very careful about whether or not that is going to allow us then to turn and say that we're not defending homophobia too. Because we can't be like the Russian Constitutional Court and say we want the rights and freedoms on this side, but not on that side. If there are going to be rights and freedoms to enjoyment, we have to ask if they might not wind up having to be rights and freedoms for all. And that's precisely why the specter of the Sadean universe opens before us.
Maybe I come to my question. I'm sorry because I've written it, and when I read, I'm worse than when I just speak. Sorry. So, as I said before, you're talking in general, your work lead us to question both the meaning of the anti-discriminatory laws and campaigns promoted by Europe, which Italy resists, and the meaning of Italian resistance to these laws and campaigns. But let's leave Italy apart. More generally, the question your work raises in me are, what does queerness structurally represent in our symbolic order for provoking this violent resistance? And what do liberal anti-discriminatory laws and campaigns really represent on their turn? Which is the price LGBT movements have to pay in order to be protected by law? And which is the difference between queerness as a critical concern and the liberal project of LGBT normalization? These are the questions your talk have raised in me and your work in general have raised in me. But I'm not totally sure if in your talk and in your work I have already found the answers. As you already know, my doubt on your work is in fact if your understanding of queerness makes queerness still a political force, or if, on the contrary, your understanding of queerness is a depoliticization of queerness. In other words, my doubt is if the bad education you teach is a political education, an education for political engagement, or on the contrary, an education for political disengagement. In No Future, we affirmed, this is, I quote, that the child remains the perpetual horizon of every acknowledged politics, the phantasmatic beneficiary of every political intervention. But if politics is structurally linked to the child and to the fantasy of the future, how can repudiating the child and the future be still a political act? My impression is that 10 years have passed from the future, and in your work, something has changed. In your article, Ever After, the one that we have read before the conference, for instance, I find very interesting the way you confront the thought of Ernesto Laclau, or Laclau, how do you pronounce it? French?
No.
Laclau, okay. Ernesto Laclau, who unluckily is now disappeared, but who we had the privilege to know some years ago when he also was a guest of our university here. We also have a PhD student here, Alice Cristini, that has worked on radical democracy and on Laclau and Mouffe. So maybe, I don't know if she wants to join with a question. But if I well understand, you agree with Laclau for his interpretation of the social as a wannabe universality. For you, as for Laclau, the social is an aspiration to an universality that can never be achieved, because in reality, universality is always exclusive and always threatened by the singularities excluded from the universal. For example, by the ones who are made for figure Jouissant and the Bertrand. But there is also one point where you disagree with Laclau. That is the normative part of his theory. For Laclau, because of the structure of the social, for a subject, position, or identity to become political, for a subject, position, or identity to become political means claiming for universalization, transcending its particularity and becoming a moment in a chain of equivalence. For you, instead, queerness or symptomosexuality resists every transcendence and every equivalence because the drive is stubbornly equivalent only to itself. Your queerness does not seek for alliances or coalitions, does not claim for hegemony, does not address the suffering of the other. Your queerness is bad and enjoys its badness. There is an enjoyment, a jouissance of badness. As you said in your talk, jouissance is the real experience of queer freedom. This freedom is a freedom without a subject, the philosophical subject, the subject as we generally conceive the subject. It is a freedom of the drive. I wonder, to what extent is this freedom without subject still a political freedom? You say your theory of freedom reshapes the political, or the way we can think to the political. So my final question is then, why do you want to be recognized as a political thinker and not, for example, as an ethical post-political thinker? What's the importance of the adjective political for you and for the world?
If I'm remembering correctly, there were at least 7 questions in that response.
I said eight.
Perhaps I should start at the end and try to work backwards. So the question that you ended with was, why would I want to think of myself as operating within the realm of the political rather than identifying myself as a post-political thinker? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what a post-political thinker would mean, since the post in post-political would presuppose that the political had been terminated, that one could move beyond the realm of the political. And it seems to me that that's that temporality of moving beyond the realm of political is already a futuristic fantasy. It's already the fantasy that one can escape from the construction of the subject. So it seems to me that we are stuck with the political. The question then is, what does the political name? And what does the political do? How do we conceptualize the political? And what opportunities are there to move the understanding of the political from the way in which the political is generally conceived and understood at the moment to something perhaps that would be different? The reason that I think initially you felt that, in your reading, my work was rejecting the political, was because even in that moment when I'm in No Future identifying every political movement as such with the fantasy of the child, I'm identifying that link, that connection between politics and the futurity invested in the child, precisely because politics as such presents itself, every form of political organization as such presents itself as a movement in the name of realizing the good. The political is linked to a philosophical ideal of the good that it attempts to realize. To the extent that there is a vision of the good that the political intends to realize, it will always have as its ultimate figure, explicitly or not, a child. It will always have a future that it wants to realize, in which the good will reign, in which the constraints on the good will have been overcome. That doesn't mean that every political thinker, however, is a thinker of futurity. There are political thinkers who resist the lure of futurity and who propose the possibility of another version of politics, a version of politics which is not, to use a word that is much used in certain political circles in the United States these days, reparative. It is not a vision of the future that has the fantasy of overcoming division or antagonism. Thinkers of that sort of politics, and I believe that Benjamin, whom I spoke about earlier, was one of them, I think in his own way, in a certain sense, almost despite himself, Alain Badiou is another. These thinkers do not hold out a vision of the future in which it would ever be possible or desirable to realize the good. Indeed, for Benjamin, you'll remember that Benjamin says that one should not engage in acts of revolution in the name of one's children or in the name of one's grandchildren, that one engages in acts of revolution in the name of one's grandparents, in the name of the past, not the future, to redeem the failures of the past, to create the space in which what history has lost or forgotten can be recalled, called back, returned. Similarly, Badiou offers, with his notion of the transformation of the social order that is through the intervention of an event, something that ruptures the order of human experience, opens onto the possibility that being as it is, the world as it is, social structures as they are, the political as we know it, must itself be ruptured by something that is contained within it, but unrecognizable to it. That thing, using set theory, Badiou refers to the null set, the set with no elements, that is always present within every set, but that can't be represented, can't be presented. In that sense, queerness is like the null set, within every set and within every social structure, within every politics and within every political organization. Queerness is always present to open up, to rupture that structure from within in something like an event, something that transforms the shape of the social order for a time, but only for a time, and not for necessarily the good, not in order to realize the good or bring about a better society, but rather it names the moment at which a repudiated form of enjoyment finds a way of gaining expression. And to the extent that one wants to generalize or universalize queerness, it's not about finding common cause with the suffering of the other, to quote a phrase that you used. It's not Levinasian in that way, because that figure of the suffering other is always a dominator's vision of the other. It's always the vision of the other seen from the perspective of power. And there is no more subtle ruse of power than the Levinasian fantasy of abjecting yourself before the face of the other, of turning the other into the figure of God. Because finally what that means is that you're the one that recognizes God, and the suffering other doesn't even know that she or he is God. And that perverse empowerment is precisely what all identifications with the suffering of the other entail. Queerness is not about identifying with the suffering of the other. Queerness is about experiencing the opening onto an enjoyment, which is radically opposed to identifying with the suffering of the other. Why think of the other always in terms of its suffering? Why not allow and enforce and secure the enjoyment of the other? But of course, it's much more frightening to secure the enjoyment of the other than it is to identifying with the suffering with the other. Because of course, in identifying with the suffering of the other, what you're really saying is you want the other to suffer. The other is only lovable suffering. We can all love the suffering. We can't love the enjoying. It's very easy to think, for instance, and this is something that's true of Agamben in much of his work, to think of Agamben when he writes about the Holocaust, to think about the other in terms of the subject of the Holocaust, the Muslim. But of course, in order truly to experience the otherness of the subject of the Holocaust, one must be able to dislike him. One must be able to say, the people who are suffering horrendous things are not necessarily good people, are not necessarily people we would like or want as our neighbors. They may be people that if we knew, we would hate too. The point is that whether we hate them doesn't matter. That's not what determines our relation to them. Why would we hate them if we hated them? We would hate them because of their enjoyment. We can love them because of their suffering. The question is, can we learn to accept their enjoyment? That's the more difficult challenge. Thank you.
Yomita Choji. Do you have other question? Maybe we can end here.
I'm at your disposal.
Okay, I think we can go here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mille grazie.